evening. Thanks for coming back. This is now week six out of nine. I'm really proud that we've reached week six and we still have an olam. We still have people here. So this is good. Topic for tonight, following on the first couple of weeks where we talked about Chubo's response that dealt with conflicts between halacha and science and observed reality. We talked about the approach of the Rashba. We talked about the approach of the Balei HaTosfos and how that shaped opinions down till today. And then the second set that we reviewed, we talked about approaches to martyrdom, what to do when compelled to break from Judaism, and we had the Rambam's approach for the Jews of Morocco, and then we had the approach of Ashkenaz, thank you, the authors of the Tosfos, Sefer Hasidim, and responsa that followed from that school, and how they dealt with the issue. So tonight, we begin what may be 2 weeks worth on the issue of Kollel study. Now, coming from last week, the week before, where we were dealing with matters of physical life and death, you might say, well, that I understand. That changed Jewish history because it dictated what Jewish communities would do over centuries and centuries of conflict. Is this really something which changed Jewish history? I believe the answer is yes, not just because I work in a kollel, but I believe the answer is yes because of what the kollel represents in Jewish history. Number one, just the basic concept that there is merit to Torah study, there is merit for the community when there are individuals who are learning. Number two, in terms of the role of a kollel as the R&D department, more or less, of Judaism, research and development. If I want to have scholars who will know how to deal with issues of the day, people who are going to be able to say, oh, you're asking me about that, some new technology, some new ethics issue, or whatever, well, actually, there's a Gemara, there's a Tosis, there's a Rambam. I need to have people who are sitting and studying, just like they do in any field, whether it's physics or whether it's economics or any other field. You need to have people who are experts and people who will devote significant time to doing research. So that's another reason why this was a major issue, this question of kollel study. Another, of course, is that it was a way to generate teachers. We find over and over again that the leaders of the Jewish communities, certainly of the past 1,000 years, but even before it, were people who first had spent significant time in study. Then they went from that to take leadership positions in Jewish communities. Finally, supporting this sort of a system, I feel like a commercial, I'm not. But supporting this sort of a system demonstrated a community's values for the next generation. So all of this, all four of these items that I just mentioned, I think there were four, the merit of Torah study, the R&D department, the way to generate leaders for the community, and demonstrating the community's values for the next generation, these are all reasons why kollel became a major force. And when I use the term kollel, I probably should have defined it first before using it in the beginning. What I mean is funded Torah study. The idea that there are people who sit and learn, and they are supported by individuals or by the community as a whole. In some cases, they also taught. They also played a professional role within the community. And in some cases, they simply studied. In some cases, it was open-ended. And in some cases, it was for a specific period of time. But that is the concept of kollel. And the question that we need to address is the question of whether this kollel thing is actually a good idea. And what we're going to see are two opposing views. We're going to see the view of the Rambam, and then we're going to see the view of the Tashbetz, Rav Shmuel ben Tzemach Duran. So I explained why I think this belongs in a series on changing Jewish history, major factors and major influences in Jewish history. However, there's a reason why it doesn't belong in this course. And the reason it doesn't belong in this course technically, not that we're not going to do it, but the reason why it doesn't belong technically is because this is a course about responsa that changed Jewish history. And first thing to realize is that really none of what we're going to see are actual responsa. When we talk about responsa, remember we discussed this in terms of Sajagon in the first week. The responsa really means somebody sent a question to a sage and the sage wrote an answer, right? that's what we call it in Hebrew. We call it a tshuva. In English, response. I like to respond. None of the sources we're going to see are actually responsive. The Rambam writes about it in his commentary to Pirkei Avot. He writes about it in his Mishneh Torah, his work of law. And we'll see what he had to say. Those are not responsive. The Tashbetz writes about it in a work which is called Shut Tashbetz, She'elos U'Tshuvos Tashbetz, question and answers of the Tashbetz. However, it becomes very clear when you read his text that no one actually asked him the question. He was simply writing the answer without having been asked. We'll see it. It's fairly clear in his writing. That doesn't stop him from spending no fewer than 7 tshuvot on the topic. 7 responsa, one after the other, dealing with different aspects of the issue. But it's not really a tshuva. I include it again because the issue is so important and because it mattered so much down through the ages. I'm just noting that it wasn't actually a responsa. The other reason why this technically doesn't belong in the series is that these tshuvot themselves did not resolve the issue. The work of the Tashbetz, which we're going to focus on for much of tonight, does not resolve the issue. It's not as though Tashbetz says what he says, and then afterwards everybody says, okay, this is what you do, CF Tashbetz, he already handled it. Every generation writes the book anew on this issue, taking either side. Some taking the view of the Rambam, some taking the view articulated by Tashbetz, but they don't even necessarily quote those who came before. And the reason for that, I think, is because we're going to see there are primary sources, sources from Tanakh, sources from the Gemara, on either side that overshadow what anybody could say about them. Meaning, I'm going to take one side and argue I have 5 sources that support me. You could easily take the other side and show 5 sources that support you. It's impossible to write a definitive work which is going to resolve all of the different sources. There simply is a conflict. When I lived in Pennsylvania, we brought out a friend of mine, Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechhofer, for a Shabbos. And he gave a shiur there, in the course of which he talked about a concept which appears in Pirkei Avos, called Machlokes Shasofo Lehiskayim, a debate which will endure. Right? You remember the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? The Mishnah says that there a Machlokes L'Shem Shamayim, a debate which is for the sake of heaven, will endure. And he explained that what that means is that sometimes there's a debate within Judaism for which there is no right and wrong. Both sides actually are correct. It's not as though you can actually paskin between them. And on this issue, I believe the same principle applies. There is no right and wrong. You can go through the sources in the Gemara, as we will, and argue either side of the question, is kolal study appropriate, is kolal study inappropriate, you can argue both sides based on the sources, so that there is no way that Tashbetz can claim, although he will, you know, here's the answer. And there's no way that the Rambam can claim, although he will, here's the answer. And therefore, these responsa or these writings don't actually change Jewish history in and of themselves. They provide more material. But every generation successively comes along and rehashes the issue. Are we clear so far? Okay, we haven't actually gotten to the meat of it. All we've done is preface, but it's an important preface, I think. So let's see where this goes. First, there's a history of supported learning before Rambam and Tashbetz ever show up on the scene. Okay, Rambam, remember, Tashbetz, well, Rambam, we're talking about the 12th into the 13th century. Tashbetz, you're talking about the 14th century. We're going to see key passages from the Gemara that make it clear that in Talmudic times, there were financial privileges for students of Torah. That's going to be clear cut. We'll see it straight out. We're also going to see a little bit of the support that went on in the Gaonic period. We talked about the Gaonic period back in the first week of the class, period from, call it, the 7th to 10th centuries, roughly. There was a family called the B'nai Netira. There was another family called the B'nai Aharon. These were major banking families in Pumbedita, in what is today Iraq. And they were patrons of the yeshivot, under of Saja Gaon, under of Shmuel Rav Chafni Gaon. We have records of it. They are supporting the yeshiva. The guys in the yeshiva are not out holding down jobs and then learning at night. They're supported by the community. A gentleman named Chazda Ibn Shafrut did the same thing for scholars in Spain at the end of that at the end of the Gaonic period. We'll see more in a letter that the Tashbetz quotes. So the idea of supported learning is not news. when the Rambam writes about it and says this is a terrible idea, he's not dealing with an idea that somebody floated. He's dealing with a reality and saying that he doesn't endorse it. It continues in the period of the Rishonim. Rashi starts his classic yeshiva in Troyes when he returns from Germany, right? In France, he starts a yeshiva that's supported by communal taxes. We'll see more about it. Enough about that. I just want to point out that it's an existing phenomenon in their world. It's not something that's hypothetical. It's not a question that's been asked. It exists as an institution by the time that the Rambam and the Tashbates come on the scene. So let's take a look at what the Rambam has to say. If you have the sheets that I emailed out, you might have the Hebrew as well as the English. If you have the sheets that the office printed, you have just the English. If anyone wants the Hebrew as well, feel free to email me or give me your email address after the shiur, and I'll be glad to email you the copy that has Hebrew as well as English. The English is my own quick translation. Any errors, as always, are mine. The Rambam, commenting on the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, says the following. Know that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos already stated, do not make Torah into a blade with which to dig. Meaning, do not consider Torah a tool for support. The text explained that anyone who benefits from the honor of Torah in this world is cutting off his soul from life in the next world. People have hidden their eyes from this clear language, casting it after their bodies, relying on interpretations of passages they do not understand. But I'll explain. Don't worry about it, says the Rambam. They have placed laws upon individuals and communities. They have turned the Torah's positions into the law of tax collectors, and they have brought people to believe total foolishness, that it is necessary and mandatory for them to aid sages and students and people who are involved in Torah and whose trade is Torah. They're brainwashing people, says the Rambam, into believing that they are required to support these institutions. And the Rambam says, all of this is in error. There is nothing in Torah to validate it. There is no leg upon which they could rely in any way. Were we to examine the chronicles of the sages of blessed memory, we would not find that they ever placed obligations upon people, or gathered money for the exalted and honored yeshivot, or for the exilarchs or judges or spreaders of Torah or appointed leaders or others. He says, ain't no such thing. Now, the Tashbates is going to bring you chapter and verse to show you that there is such a thing, which is going to create a little bit of a problem. The Rambam, you know, far better than anybody else knows the sources. So what exactly is he doing here? Something we have to get to. We're not going to get to that this week. We'll have to see some of the explanations, God willing, next week. But he says, in all of their communities, meaning the communities of the sages of old, there were people at the height of poverty and people at the height of wealth. He says, how could it be that there were paupers? How could it be that there were people who were in need? God forbid to say that those wealthy people were not generous and were not philanthropic. Rather, had this pauper extended his hand, they would have filled his house with gold and gems. But he didn't do so. He didn't want to take money. Rather, he survived with the work from which he was supported, whether with ease or under strain, and he disdained that which came by the hand of man, since the Torah prevented it. So the Rambam has shifted his argument here. Let's track what the Rambam is doing. His first argument was, there's no basis in Torah for having other people support you while you study. That was his first argument. His second argument is, in general, it's not good to be supported. Forget whether you're studying or not. He says the reason why there were needy people in ancient times, even though there were wealthy people, is because they didn't want to take a handout. And so, too, we shouldn't look for a handout. Yes? You're talking Yisachar Zebulun. Right, so the Rambam has not addressed at all Yisachar Zebulun. He's pretending that Yisachar Zebulun doesn't exist. Even though we certainly have such a tradition, absolutely, that the Medrash talks about it, Smach Zebulun B'tzeisecha, Yisachar B'alecha. How does it work? Zebulun goes out with his ships and brings back the wealth, and Yisachar sits in the tent and he studies Torah. Absolutely. The Rambam is not even going to mention it in the course of his discussion. It's as though it's not there.
What does that mean to be granted?
Sorry. The Torah mentions the blessings that are given to Yisachar and Zebulun by their father Yaakov. Yaakov has 12 sons. Yisachar is one of them, Zebulun is another of them. And in the blessing that Yaakov gives to his sons before he passes on, he says, Yisachar, you should be happy with your Yes, that is that set of brachos. I just wanted to check something. Sorry. He says, Zevulun should be happy when he goes out, and Yisachar should be happy in his tent. So the sages understood that there was actually a deal, because we find other references in Tanakh to the family of Yisachar, the descendants of Yisachar, being scholars. They were called Yodei Binali Itim. They knew the calendar, they knew the calculations, they knew the law, and that they were teachers of Torah. So that the idea is, sitting in the tent, as with Yaakov himself, Yoshev Ohalim, dweller of tents, is a sign that he's a student of Torah. And they're juxtaposed there because Zebulun goes out, he makes money, he brings it back, and he supports his brother. It's actually become even a term, a Yisachar Zebulun contract, which is a very controversial matter within Jewish law as to how exactly it works. But essentially the idea is that one person says, I'll provide the money in exchange for you studying, and I'll receive the merit of your studying, or I'll receive half the merit of your studying. It's not quite clear how this works in practice, nor is it clear how God responds to it. But the core idea, meaning, you know, you think of Esav selling the birthright, right? Here he is saying, well, I'm going to learn, but I'm going to give away my reward. But the core idea, until the Rambam ignored it entirely, seems to be a given in the Medrash. Certainly, the sages talk about it. And yes, it's not here. The Rambam, you'll see, once we start reading the Tashbetz, you start wondering what the Rambam was doing when he wrote this. Did somebody sneak into the Rambam's study and write this? Because he's going to quote so many sources, and you're just flabbergasted, like, what happened? But let's see what the Rambam does. His first argument was, it never happened. His second argument was that it's better to be supported by your own hand than to take handouts from others. Third, he says, I'll give you examples. He says, you already know that Hillel the elder was a woodchopper, chopping wood and studying before Shmaya and Avtalion, right? Remember the classic story? He couldn't afford the entrance fee for the Beis Medrash. Everybody had to contribute money so that there would be a fire going to warm the room. And Hillel couldn't afford it, and he goes up onto the roof, and he stays there on the roof trying to eavesdrop on what's going on, and it snows, and he's frozen there up on the roof. He was at the height of poverty, and he was so great that his students were compared to Moshe and Yehoshua. And the least of his students was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, leader of the Jews at the end of the Second Temple. Let no intelligent person be in doubt that had Hillel agreed to receive from the people of his time, they would not have allowed him to chop wood. He says the fact that Hillel doesn't get supported is evidence. That's evidence that you don't get supported, you work for a living. In truth, he says, the error of these people who rally opposite truth and opposite the clear expressions of the law, taking people's money with their agreement or against their will. These are deeds found in the Gemara regarding men who are physically wounded, or elderly people who could no longer work, who had no means other than to take. He says, I'll grant you that there are cases talmudically of people being supported, but that's because those were people who couldn't get a job. They have no other means of support, so then they'll take money. Otherwise, what could they do? Should they die? This is not the Torah's command. So that's his fourth argument. If you find people who are being supported, it's because they couldn't get a job. That's why. Then he continues and says, I have already heard what the fools depend upon when they cite a passage from the Medrash. One who wishes to benefit may benefit like Elisha, and one who wishes not to benefit may not benefit like Shmuel Haramati. What he's talking about here is that Elisha, the Navi, right, student of Eliyahu HaNavi, traveled around Israel, and he stayed in somebody's house. He stayed on an upper floor that they had designated for him, so he was indeed aided by other people. Shmuel, on the other hand, is a Navi and a leader. He's the one who coronates the first king, Shaul HaMelech. And Shmuel travels around as well, but we don't have any record of him taking assistance from anybody. So the sages said, yeah, if you want, you can do like Elisha and be helped. You can be like Shmuel and not be helped. That's the line in the Medrash. So he says, people quote that to say, see, I can choose to be like Elisha, so I can benefit. He says, no, this is not relevant. And to me, this is corruption for one who uses it as his proof. Since the matter is clear, there is no room for error. Elisha did not accept money from people, and he certainly did not put upon them and obligate them in his portion. God forbid. He did accept the kibbutz, the honor, a little bit of something that one would give him, that one would host him when he was traveling on the road. He would stay there and eat that night or that day and then go about his business. And Shmuel did not enter anyone's home or eat his food. So, yes, it's true there's a difference between Elisha and Shmuel, but what Elisha is doing is not what everybody else is trying to justify. What Elisha is doing is somebody who offers him a place to stay. Taking a place to stay is not the same thing as having wholesale support, your entire livelihood from the community. Regarding this, the sages said that Torah scholars who wish to imitate this, not to enter anyone's home, may do so. And if they wish to be hosted by someone because of the needs of travel or similar needs, they may do so. They were already careful not to eat when unnecessary. This is in Talmudic times. As it says, the Torah scholar who increases his meals everywhere, this is a negative. The Torah scholar is not supposed to go around eating. And a Torah scholar may not benefit from a meal which is not a mitzvah meal. He's only allowed to eat at a Suda's mitzvah. The Rambam's point here is to dispel people's belief that, well, the sages of old were supported. He says, no, they weren't. That wasn't support, not like what you're talking about. But now let me ask you a question, because I've been talking now for 20 minutes and I've only been interrupted once. And I need more of an interruption than that. So let me ask you a question here. There's an undercurrent in what the Rambam has written so far that suggests that what he's opposing is not merely support for people who are learning Torah. There's something stronger that he's opposing. Did you catch his wording? If you take a look back in particular, the passage that we just read is a perfect example. But if you look at even the second paragraph, the one that started, people have hidden their eyes. What does he mention in addition to accepting support from others? Yeah. Right. Right, but more than that. What is it that is so angering the Rambam beyond the weakness of being supported?
Burden on the community.
Burden on the community, more than that?
Dependency.
More than that?
Taxing the community.
Look at the wording that he used there. They have placed laws, back in the second paragraph, they have placed laws upon individuals and communities. Right? That I'm looking back at the Hebrew now. They turned the Torah's laws into the laws of the tax collector. They brought people to believe total foolishness, that this is necessary and this is a requirement. He doesn't like the idea that people are telling the community, you must do this. It's not only the matter of you shouldn't be supported by others. It's you shouldn't be telling the community that they must support you. That's a critical piece. It was in the paragraph that we just read as well. He said, there was one line in there. Yes. Elisha did not accept money from people, and he certainly did not put upon them and obligate them in his portion. He never went to anybody and said, you have to support me. The Rambam is aggravated not only by people taking assistance, but people requiring assistance, requiring others to support them, to assist them. Yes?
Do you have any
You got it. What's the difference between that and this? Yes. I have a pasuk in the Torah that says, give truma, give the tithe to the Kohen. Right? I have a pasuk in the Torah that says, give maaser, I have to give a tithe to the Levi. Having said that, hang in a little bit, because we're going to get to it. You're right. We're going to get there. The Rambam says, the bottom paragraph, well, it's not, I'm reading off the Hebrew-English one. On yours, it's not. No, it's also the bottom paragraph on the page. Why do I go on at length on this matter, asks the Rambam. Why am I talking about this so much? I'll mention the Talmudic account. He says, I have a story to tell you from the Gemara. And one who is stubborn will do as he wishes. All I can do is tell you what's right. After that, do what you want, says the Rambam in best Jewish mother style. A man had a vineyard, and thieves would enter it. Daily, he found the grapes reduced, And he was certain the thieves had targeted it. He was upset all through the season until he finally harvested what he could collect. He laid it out to dry. He collected the raisins. Generally, when people gather dried fruit, some of the figs and raisins fall away, right? You can't catch everything. And one may eat them, meaning a stranger can come along and eat that which is dropped, for they are hefger. Hefger means ownerless. Abandoned by their owners because they are few, right? The owner says, forget it, what fell on the ground I'm not going to bother with. Well, Rabbi Tarfon happened by this vineyard one day, and he sat and collected the fallen raisins and he ate them. The owner of the vineyard came, thought he, Rabbi Tarfon, was the thief, and did not recognize him, although he knew the name of Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon was famous. So he knew there was a Rabbi Tarfon, he just didn't know who he was. He rushed to catch him, overpowered him, put him in a sack, and rushed with Rabbi Tarfon on his back to throw him in the river. When Rabbi Tarfon saw he would be lost, he cried out, "Woe to Tarfon, that this man would kill him!" When the vineyard owner heard this, he put down Rabbi Tarfon and fled, knowing he had committed a great sin. He said, "Oh no, this man in the bag is Rabbi Tarfon." And for the rest of his life, Rabbi Tarfon mourned and wailed for what had happened, that he had saved his life through the honor of Torah. So the Rambam quotes this in order to say, see, we don't want to benefit by the fact that we are Torah scholars. We don't want to say to other people, help me out because I am a sage. He was a person of means, Rabbi Tarfon. And he could have said, leave me be and I will pay you X dinar, I'll pay you some amount. And he could have paid without letting the man know that he was Tarfon, and so he could have saved his life through his wealth rather than through Torah. That's why Rabbi Tarfon is aggravated. He's not aggravated about saving his own life. You have to save your life. He's aggravated about what he did in order to do it. It's classic, right? After you leave the room, you think of what you should have said. Right? That's the way it works. After you finish the shiur, you think of the way you could have worded it. So Rabbi Tarfon saves his life in a panic by saying, I'm Rabbi Tarfon. And afterwards he says, no, what I should have done was said, I'll pay you. That's how I should have saved myself. But he's upset about having benefited from his title. Another story. Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, canonizer of the Mishnah, opened the stores of wheat during a famine and declared, any who wish to take their means may come and do so if they are Torah scholars. This is a special support for people who study. Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram stood before him, and Rabbeinu HaKadosh did not recognize him. So the student comes up. Rabbeinu HaKadosh doesn't know who he is. And he said, the student says, support me. Rabbeinu HaKadosh asked him, what is your level of learning? And he said, feed me as a dog or raven, meaning, feed me even if I have no wisdom, just as God feeds non-kosher animals and birds. For an Am Haaretz, someone who is just regular and not learned, is no worse than them. And so Rabbeinu HaKadosh fed him, and indeed Rabbeinu HaKadosh did feed him. The point that the Rambam brings is that he doesn't want to say, I study Torah, therefore you should feed me. He doesn't want to be supported for his scholarship. Now, the Rambam has a problem. He's brought anecdotes. He's explained his basis from the Gemara. He's given us something to think about. But he does have a problem, because there are passages in the Gemara that talk about supporting a Talmid Chacham. So he addresses that here. And he says, that which the Torah permitted for Torah scholars is that they, the Torah scholars, may give a person money and have him engage in business of his choosing on their behalf. That you can do. You could ask somebody, do me a favor, you're an investor, take my money and invest it well for me. One who does this for them receives reward. And this is the meaning of what's called in the Gemara, Matil Malai Lekis Talmid Chacham, putting merchandise into the wallet of Torah scholars. The merchandise is sold to whomever. They receive the first of the market specifically. The scholars do. These are the portions God established for the sages, just as, here you go, he established gifts for the Kohen and tithes for the Levi, as is our tradition. He says, you're right. Truma and Masya, gifts for the Kohen and Levi, exist, and there is something that's appropriate for the Torah scholar. Not a pure gift, though. Just that, when he competes on the market, will give him an advantage. That will give him. And he says, what's my basis for saying that's okay? Because you do that all the time anyway on the market. Human beings give precedence to other human beings. Give priority, I should say, to other human beings. He says, look, merchants already engage in these activities for each other as a show of respect, even if there is no greater wisdom involved. let Torah scholars be no less than a respected Am Haaretz. He says, look, you have two merchants, Shimon and Levi. Okay? Shimon and Levi are in the market. Shimon says to Levi, after you, my friend. So, it happens. It happens all the time. So, why shouldn't the Talmud Chacham also deserve that somebody says to him, after you, I'll let you go first? As a matter of respect, he says, that's okay. Not only that, there's more precedent he has to deal with. The Torah also exempted Torah scholars from the obligations of the ruler, that which the government would require, from taxes and billeting, putting up soldiers, and head taxes, which the community pays on their behalf, and the construction of walls and the like. The Rambam is stuck, because it's an explicit Gemara that says that the scholars are exempted from these things. So the Rambam acknowledges that's true. Even a wealthy Torah scholar would not be obligated in this. It's not a matter of charity to support them. And this is the Rambam's key point. It's not about getting your support as a Torah scholar, as evidenced by the fact that even if you don't need it, you're still exempt. Look at the story. Ravna Yosef Halevi already ruled thus. This is a ruling from the Gaonim. For a man in Andalusia who owned gardens and vineyards, which required a tax of 1,000 dinar. And he exempted the man from the tax because he was a Torah scholar, although even the poorest Jew paid that tax. This is the law of the Torah, just as it exempted Kohanim from the half shekel. The Rambam says, you're right. There's a caste, so to speak, of Torah scholars, and they are exempt from certain things, but it's not about supporting them while they study. It's about the Torah that they study being treated with a certain respect, and we manifest that respect by saying, you don't have to do certain things. You're exempt from certain things. Just like the Kohen works in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple, and he gets certain gifts. The Levi works in the temple and gets certain gifts. So too the Torah scholar gets certain gifts. That the Rambam says I'm okay with. My problem is taking money from the community for your support and insisting that the community support you. Everyone follow the difference? It's not a small difference. We got a, I saw a note. Yes? You were talking about the Kohen and the Levi.
So I don't think this, the analogy holds for that.
Right. The problem is that that section, Hashem Hunach L'Asam, is not about support we give. Hashem Hunach L'Asam is where it says that they don't get land.
No, because they're not working the land. Instead, they're working the vineyards. They're supported because they're not able to work the land. Therefore, we
right, but I don't think the two go together. If I remember the pasuk correctly, in other words, we're talking about giving land to all the other tribes. And we're told, this is the plot of this one, this is the plot of this one. When you get to those who work in the temple, Hashem Hunach L'Asam, we don't want them working the land, as you said. We want them instead working for Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash.
That's why you have to support them, because they're doing God's work and they're not doing regular work with everybody else.
Right. So I don't think the Rambam agrees. I think based on his formulation here, the Rambam thinks it's not so. I think he thinks that this is a something that we accord to them. It's something we give to them in honor of the work that they do. How will the Torah scholars support themselves? They go out and they chop wood and... I understand what you're saying, but I think that's what the Rambam is suggesting. Right. I hear you. I don't see... the truth is that the Kohen isn't really at work all that much in the Beis HaMikdash. You have shifts and the Kohen goes in for his week's shift and then he's out. Right. Originally, they did have a role teaching, but teaching, you can get supported. In other words, you say, well, I'm not going out and getting a job as X, so therefore pay me some arbatala. He wants to be paid for his job. He's not being paid to sit and study. He's being paid to teach. So I think that he'd be able to do that. It's an interesting question. Really, what it requires is that we look at the Rambam in his Mor Nevuchim and see, and maybe in as well as in Matnos Kahuna, and see how he words the gifts we give to the Kohanim. Does he look at it as something we do to show honor to them, or does he look at it as a means of support? Right. It's a good question. I'm not sure.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Could it possibly be that he's aware of the, with hindsight, the corruption that existed at the time of the temple, the Kohen themselves, the competition, the conflict that they had, was it all part of this getting the type of thing.
See, it's interesting. He doesn't discuss that, but I think he certainly is concerned about corruption. I think the idea of creating a culture of taking, and not even corruption as much as just the general dishonor that it brings to the study of Torah, because now it's more about, well, he doesn't want to work, and therefore he's coming to me and telling me that I have to support him. I think that he sees. That's there in his words. I don't see him mention corruption, really. Yeah, I don't really see that. Take a look at the next source, please, at number 2, and I think he makes it more clear there. It's more concise. It's from his Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's work of law. He says, one who sets his goal to involve himself in Torah and not engage in work and to be supported by tzedakah desecrates God's name, disgraces the Torah, extinguishes the light of religion, and causes evil for himself and removes his life from the next world, for one may not benefit from words of Torah in this world. The sages said, one who benefits from words of Torah removes his life from the world. They further instructed, do not make them a crown in which to be elevated or a blade with which to dig. They further instructed, love work and hate authority. Not hate authority, but hate holding positions of authority. And all Torah that does not include work with it will be nullified and will lead to sin, and in the end one will become a bandit. There is a great level in supporting oneself with the work of one's hands. This was the trait of the early pious ones, the Hasidim HaRishonim. And through this one merits all honor and goodness in this world and the next, as it is written, when you eat the labor of your hands, you are fortunate, it is good for you, a passage from Mishle. You are fortunate in this world, it is good for you in the next world, which is entirely good. So the Rambam's formulation here is much more concise. And his concern is, it disgraces the Torah, it's an abuse of the Torah. You're using the Torah as a commodity. Has the Rambam left any doubt as to his position? Is there any room to think maybe we've been misunderstanding what he said here? Not so much, no? I don't think so either.
But what does Justin say?
Yes.
It seems to me that the essence of worry is that I think that if you're just studying, you can get totally crazy ideas, but if you're working, you're going to have ideas, philosophical, maybe abstract ideas that are grounded in reality. And he doesn't say this, but I think that's where he's coming from.
Right, so that's an interesting question. That will be an entirely different shiur. We have to have our own session on this. But it's interesting to look at how they viewed work and the value of a person having a trade, the value of a person working with the earth, because there is a lot of discussion about that and what the benefits are and why it's supposed to be recommended. There is that piece of it. He doesn't, as you said, he doesn't go into it here. But there's plenty of discussion about it. It becomes very big, especially 130 years ago, at the time when Jews start to make aliyah out of the Pale of Settlement, and you find people saying, you know, returning to the land and working the land will be good for us. Not just in terms of having a land and a place to be safe and all of that, but in terms of developing ourselves. Okay. We're not going to finish the Tashbetz. Yes? Yes. Right, so he doesn't. And it's a separate discussion. The Rambam discusses it elsewhere. He doesn't discuss it in the context of not being paid for Torah. He has the separate discussion, which is based in the Gemara, the debate about whether I'm allowed to charge for teaching and what kind of teaching one can charge for. But the general basis for teachers of Torah getting paid is they're being paid to not take other jobs, because then we won't have teachers. So in other words, we're saying to them, you don't become a physician, you don't become a lawyer, because we need you to do this, so we have to pay you. Yeah. Yes, that's essentially what it is. Okay. So let's start the Tashbetz. We're not going to finish it tonight, we're going to start it. And look at the opening of what he says. For those who have the Hebrew, it's going to be at the bottom of a page, so you'll have to catch that. It's the bottom of the fourth side. This is only his first of 7 responsa on the topic. Now, it happens also to be the longest, to be fair, and I translated most of it, but the other ones all deal with different facets of the issue. So first of all, who was the Tashbetz? Meaning, you know, I walked into Rambam and felt pretty comfortable. People know who Maimonides is, basically. Who is Tashbetz? The Tashbetz is, I mentioned his name before, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran. He's born in 1361 in Mallorca. He's a student of Rivash, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Sheshet Perfet, who we discussed actually in a previous class on the Crusades. Actually, no, we discussed him on science and halacha. He was a student of the school of the Rashba, who said that that we ignore people when they tell us that they've observed something that's different from what was predicted in the halacha. Interestingly, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran starts out in life studying medicine to support himself because he doesn't want to be supported by the community. He follows what the Rambam says. However, he's forced out by persecution in 1391, and he, along with his mentor, the Rivash, flees to Algeria. He loses all of his property in the flight, and he ends up being supported by the community. So that which he had specifically wanted to avoid ended up being his fate. His mentor, the Rivash, became the head of the Jewish community in Algeria till he passed away in 1408, at which point the Tashbetz took over and he served as the head of the Jewish community in Algeria for 36 years until his own death in the year 1444. Okay, so just a little bit of background about who we're talking about here. So he begins by informing us that our goal ought to be the honor of the Torah, to honor the Torah of the teachers, and to honor the Torah of students as well. And this is what he has to say. Because I have seen many people hesitate regarding the practice of all Jewish communities in all generations of paying their sages, right? He's not shy. Right, the practice of all Jewish communities in all generations. And in this they depend upon what the Rambam wrote in his commentary to Avot. People who hesitate and say, maybe this isn't right, so they base themselves on the Rambam that we just read. Therefore, I will examine this issue as heaven guides me, from Gemara and other sources, to see whether this is permissible, mitzvah, or obligatory, or whether it involves some element of sin. Maybe it's actually sinful. I am confident in the strength of the early authorities who customarily permitted this, so that I will not stumble in a matter of law, and all of the relevant issues will be cleansed and clarified. Tell me, from reading that opening paragraph, who is he answering with his tshuva here, with his responsum?
Rambam.
Right, but who is he addressing it to? He's addressing it to the community at large. No one asked him a question. Normally, a responsum begins with, regarding your question of such and such, here's my answer. That's the way it's supposed to start. Not, I've decided to pontificate on something that I thought people were confused about. So, this is not a true responsum.
Yeah, but there may be people who are reluctant towards scholars, and that's why it's coming up.
Oh, yeah, no, I think it's exactly why. I think it's exactly why. And that's why, even though I said at the beginning it isn't a true responsum, isn't true responsa literature. Nonetheless, it fits within the overall picture of what we're doing because it's the way a sage would write a letter to address a major issue of the day. He's just doing it without having been asked. That's all. It's spontaneous responsa. The sound of one voice answering. So he says, I say that the Jewish people are obligated to support with honor their sages and judges whose livelihoods are their Torah, so that they will not need to cease their heavenly work for the sake of malacha, malacha is work, and so that they will not be disgraced before amei ha'aretz, unlearned people, because of their poverty, and so they will be treated with honor. That's the key paragraph. What we just read is the key paragraph. Everything else is just going to support that. What is his reason for supporting sages? He has two reasons, right? What are his two reasons? Right, honor, to be not be disrespected. What, and what's the other reason? Right, they'll stop studying otherwise. We need our R&D department. We need our leaders. How are we going to have them if we're not going to give them fellowships? That's the way it works. So he says, the root of this comes from Torah as explained by the sages. He says this isn't just a pragmatic statement or my own personal position. Look at the sages. They explained in Yoma 18a, Hariot 9a, it is written, The Kohen who is greater than his brethren. This is the description of the Kohen Gadol, who leads the work in the Beis HaMikdash. The Torah says, V'ha-Kohen ha-Gadol me'achav. The Kohen who is greater than his brethren, dot, dot, dot. But the way he takes it is, the way the Gemara takes it is, he is greater than his brethren means he should be greater than his brethren in beauty, strength, knowledge, and wealth. Why is it important for the Kohen Gadol to be greater in all four of these areas? Why beauty? Sorry?
Is it physical beauty?
Yes, physical beauty.
They have to have no
right, but why do we want him to be so handsome? Because he represents the work in the Beis HaMikdash, right? You want people to go into the Beis HaMikdash and see something that's going to be so awesome for them that they're going to say, wow, that's something to be proud of. And the reality is, we don't like it, and we all tell our children, I hope we all tell our children, beauty is only skin deep, and shekhar achein ve'evel hayofi, and your beauty is false, and all those other things. I hope we tell all our children that. However, the reality is that people are affected by aesthetics. And you want people to come away from the Beis HaMikdash proud of what they saw. And so you had gold implements that were used there, and everything was done up with very fancy and beautiful, and everything, all of that, along with this, the Kohen Gadol should be handsome. He should be impressive. You want him to be strong for the same reason. You don't want people to say that the Kohen Gadol is weak, unimpressive. The knowledge, well, we want him to be wise, we want him to know. And wealth. Why wealth? Yes, they won't take from the community. You want to make sure you have somebody honest who isn't dependent on people in the community. We don't want patronage. We don't want indulgences. So those are the four things that you need. So what do you do if you have a Kohen Gadol who isn't greater? What happens then? So others, Acherim, as it's mentioned in the source, said, if he lacks this, then his brother Kohenim elevate him. Now, they can't elevate him by making him any more handsome than he was. That's not going to help. That they can't do. Maybe they can help him work out. You have somebody spot him, and therefore they can make him stronger. Maybe. You have someone teach him, and he'll be wiser. Could be. What you're really talking about is wealth. As it is written, the Kohen who is greater than his brethren, elevate him from that which belongs to his brethren. You're supposed to make him wealthy. So says the Tashbates. Says the Tashbates. You see? We're supposed to give something to him. We want the Kohen Gadol to be elevated. So we are going to support him. He doesn't look at it as being, give him money to keep him from taking bribes. He's looking at it as, give him money in order to elevate him, to give him honor. And he's going to translate that into the honor of the Torah scholar, then give him money so that he can also be supported. And he says, they also deduced from this passage that a Torah scholar may take money to enrich himself, and there is no disgrace in it. In Chulin 134b, look at this story. This is a great story. A sack of coins was brought to the Beit Midrash, apparently for the students' use. Rabbi Ami took it first. Well, how could he do this? Did we not learn? And he shall give. Talking about the gifts given to the Kohanim. And not that one should take the gifts of the Kohanim for himself. The Kohen is not supposed to take. Somebody else is supposed to give. And they answer, how did Rabbi Ami do it? An important person is different. As we learned, they quote our source, the Kohen who is greater. The sages equated the law of an important person whom Israel are obligated to enrich with the law of a Kohen Gadol. So the idea is, as he explains, that the nation is supposed to give to him, and he is permitted indeed to take in order that the sage will be elevated. And he says, this is logical. Huh, why? For he precedes others to be given life and to have his lost property restored to him. And what he quotes here is a Gemara at the end of Harios that says that if you have somebody who is a Torah scholar and he needs support, and you have somebody who hasn't learned who needs support, you give to the Torah scholar first. If two people lost their property, one of them is a Torah scholar and one of them is not, the one who has studied, he's the one who has his lost property restored to him first. Not because the law is being written by Torah scholars, but because this is ultimately Judaism as meritocracy. That's what this fundamentally is. It's about saying, we say Talmud Torah keneged kulam, that Torah is equal to all else. This person who took that seriously and accomplished in that area is going to deserve credit. Look at the source that he quotes here. Kohen precedes Levi. Levi precedes Yisrael. This is when all involved are equal. But a mamzer, someone of illegitimate parentage, who is a Torah scholar, precedes a Kohen Gadol who is an Am Haaretz. I don't care who your parents are. If you've achieved, then you automatically deserve more. So Tashbait says, see? We're supposed to support him. We're supposed to give him more. There's more here, and I think what we'll do is we're going to come back to it next time. It's already past 9:45. But what I hope emerges here is the strength of the debate. The Rambam digging in his heels and saying, this is it. And the Tashbait's on the other side saying, I don't know what you're talking about. I can bring you source after source to show that it should be this way. And this is a debate which raged in their day and continues literally until our own times. The debate ain't over. It's one that continues on, marshaling the same sources that they brought then. Thank you very much. See you next week.